on this. Okay, so this is the third part of chapter seven of Trotsky's work on the nature of the USSR, which is titled The Revolution Betrayed. The third chapter is on the various cultural and subsidiary aspects of the degeneration of the revolution. The first part we dealt with the effect on the woman question, questions involving woman's oppression that emerged from the degeneration of the state and Trotsky's analysis of it. That was about a month and a bit ago. And then we had an educational on about 4 weeks ago on the impact of the degeneration on Soviet youth. And in this section, Trotsky deals with the impact of the same degeneration on the many nations and nationalities that made up the population of the USSR at that time. And he also deals with some subsidiary questions as well, but that is the main subject matter of this section. Because of course the USSR, as it was founded, was a very multinational and multi-ethnic state. It was the successor of Tsarism in terms of a lot of the formal area involved, not all of it, but a lot of it. And the Tsarist Empire had the character, as many have noted, of a kind of a prison house of peoples. And the smaller peoples of the Tsarist Empire were both suppressed and prevented from undergoing political and economic developments by the Tsarist regime. Until the mid-19th century, Tsarist Russia had been the potent enemy of all revolutionary and democratic development in all Europe. Also, it was a kind of absolutist feudal superpower, though it's arguable as to whether it was actually feudal or not. Some point to Marx's concept of the Asiatic mode of production as re relevant to pre-revolutionary Russia. Now, personally, I think that's doubtful. I think that concept seems to be based on major irrigation works and things like that, And that's not really the case in Russia. But irrespective of that, just after the mid-century, mid-19th century, that is, Russia was decisively weakened. And I think the event that particularly signaled that was the emancipation of the serfs in 1861, which really began the beginning of the death agony of Tsarism. Russian rural life was dominated by the rural commune or the mir, which is where the peasants owned and worked their own land in common and had a real element of collective control. And Marx actually seriously considered the idea that this incipient democracy sort of thing could play an important role in leading Russia to some sort of socialism without the kind of capitalist developments which happened in Europe. But that speculation was not borne out by subsequent events. It was falsified. And over time, the growth of capitalism in Europe led the Tsarist regime to bureaucratically graft modern capitalist industry onto its own economy to try to ensure its own survival. And that actually set off social and economic forces that it could not control. And centrally, the working class in its economic activities, that those economic activities necessarily created in major Russian cities like Moscow, St. Petersburg, Nizhny Novgorod, and others, such as there are other places as well where similar developments happened, not in Russia itself. You can think of things like Eastern Ukraine, now the Donbass, which was centered on coal, industrial growth centered on coal, and the growth of the oil industry in Azerbaijan and places like that, So the working class in the Tsarist Empire was not simply Russian. It was multinational. And the Bolshevik leadership had representatives from several different nationalities in its leadership. as well as Russians, you had Jews, you had Ukrainians, you had Georgians, Armenians, and many others. That was in the Bolshevik leadership. In terms of the composition of the USSR, as it became, or Soviet Russia as it originally was, the nations of Central Asia, which many of which were just emerging as the Tsarist Empire went into crisis. There's an umbrella term for those regions, which was Turkestan. It was originally used to describe them. But in fact, there were many nationalities that made up Soviet Central Asia as it became, which in time under Soviet rule resulted in a multiplicity of Central Asian republics. I think there's about seven or eight of them, So Trotsky's account of the Stalinist treatment of the issue of nationalities is quite scathing, but he does not actually equate that with the Tsarist regime. Very much the opposite, because despite the Tsarist regime, despite the Stalinist regime, I should say, he recognized that despite the bureaucratic degeneration, much of the progressive impetus that was imparted by the revolution still continued. So there's a particular quote from this section which I think is very salient, and he writes this. He writes, "It is true that in the sphere of national policy, as in the sphere of economy, the Soviet bureaucracy still continues to carry out part of the progressive work, though within moderate overhead expenses. This is especially true of the backward nationalities of the Union, which must of necessity pass through a more or less prolonged period of borrowing, imitation, and assimilation of what exists. The bureaucracy is laying down a bridge for them to the elementary benefits of bourgeois and in part even pre-bourgeois culture. In relation to many spheres and peoples, the Soviet power is to a considerable extent carrying out the historic work fulfilled by Peter the First and his colleagues in relation to the old Muscovy, only on a larger scale and at a swifter tempo. In the schools of the Union, lessons are taught at present in no less than 80 languages. For a majority of them, it was necessary to compose new alphabets or to replace the extremely aristocratic Asiatic alphabets with the more democratic Latin. Newspapers are published in the same number of languages, papers which for the first time acquaint the peasants and nomad shepherds with the elementary ideas of human culture. Within the far-flung boundaries of the Tsar's empire, a native industry is arising. The old semi-clan structure, culture, is being destroyed by the tractor. Together with literacy, scientific agriculture and medicine are coming into existence. It will be difficult to overestimate the significance of this work in raising up new human strata. Marx was right when he said that revolution is the locomotive of history." However, he pointed out, and this is the main theme of this section, that there was nothing specifically socialist about this. This was merely the assimilation of elements of bourgeois culture by previously deeply oppressed and suppressed populations. And he gives the example of the assimilation of basic rules of hygiene, or things like iron bedsteads or knitted underwear, as things that were new and novel, and were obviously, embraced by the newly liberated peoples. He noted the proclivity of the population of the USSR, including Russia, to imitate the West in that regard. This concept that the West was superior and to be imitated actually plagued the USSR with all its advances up to the collapse of 1991, actually. Which is going on a bit further, obviously. But such advances as Trotsky noted had nothing particularly socialist about them. They merely involved assimilating bourgeois progress and small luxuries that had previously been denied. However, Trotsky is clear on the role that the progressive contents of the revolution and economic planning played in this assimilation. So he writes that, just carrying, quoting again, he says that to say that the Soviet Union is now performing the cultural work which the advanced countries long ago performed on the basis of capitalism would be, however, only half the truth. The new social forms are by no means irrelevant. They not only give to a backward country the possibility of gaining the level of the most advanced, but they permit it to achieve this task in a much shorter space of time than was needed formerly in the West. The expansion of this acceleration of tempo is simple. The bourgeois pioneers had to invent their technique and learn to apply it in the spheres of both economy and culture. The Soviet Union takes it ready-made in its latest forms and, thanks to the socialized means of production, applies the borrowings not partially and by degrees, but at once on a gigantic scale. And he goes on he elaborates a bit more. He says, if the October Revolution had given nothing but this accelerated forward movement, it would be historically justified. For the declining bourgeois regime has proved incapable during the last quarter century of seriously moving forward any one of the backward countries in any part of the earth. However, the Russian proletariat achieved the revolution in the name of much more far-reaching tasks. No matter how suppressed it is politically at present, in its better parts, it has not renounced the communist program, nor the mighty hope bound up with it. So, the bureaucracy attempts to exploit that sentiment and at the same time to deflect it by claiming that every conquest of bourgeois culture, as referred to above, represents something socialist. Now, I mean, these conquests encourage creative thought and individuality, which were themselves, to a degree, conquests of the rise of bourgeois culture. But the bureaucracy fears such things. It encourages petty bourgeois aspiration. But, as Trotsky says, he says, the contradictions in the sphere of Soviet culture only reflect and refract the economic and social contradictions that grew out of this leap. The awakening of personality under these circumstances necessarily assumes a more or less petty bourgeois character, not only in economics, but also in family life and lyric poetry. The bureaucracy itself has become the carrier of the most extreme and sometimes unbridled bourgeois individualism, permitting and encouraging the development of economic individualism, i.e. piecework, private land allotments, premiums, decorations. It at the same time ruthlessly suppresses the progressive side of individualism in the sphere of, in the realm of spiritual culture, i.e. critical views, the development of one's own opinion, the cultivation of personal dignity. He lists those, you know. And he talks about the implications of this for the formerly oppressed nations and nationalities under Tsarism and how they are also clear. He says, the more considerable the level of development of a given national group, or the higher the sphere of its cultural creation, or again, the more closely it grapples with the problems of society and personality, the more heavy and intolerable becomes the pressure of the bureaucracy. And he points out the Ukrainian, the White Russian, the Georgian or the Turk newspapers and books are only translations of the bureaucratic imperative into the language of the corresponding nationality. Under the name of models of popular creativeness, the Moscow Press daily publishes in Russian translation odes by the prized poets of the different nationalities in honor of the leaders, miserable verses in reality which differ only in the degree of their servility and want of talent. And this applies to the Russians as well, of course. He says, on that, he says, it's a question, therefore, not of the oppression of one nationality over another in the proper sense of the word, but of oppression by the centralized police apparatus over the cultural development of all the nations, starting with the Great Russian. And actually, Trotsky is very cautious in attacking the regime as simply Russifying, noting that there's a large number of non-Russians that made up even Stalin's regime, but he could not ignore some of the material implications of the way things were developing. And he says, "We cannot, however, ignore the fact that 90% of the publications of the Soviet Union are printed in the Russian language. If this percentage is, to be sure, in flagrant contradiction with the relative number of the great Russian population, still it perhaps the better corresponds to the general influence of Russian culture, both in its independent weight and its role as mediator between the backward countries, the backward peoples of the country and the West." He does then conclude, however, the following. He says, "But with all that, does not the excessively high percentage of great Russians in the publishing houses, and not only there, of course, mean an actual autocratic privilege of the great Russians at the expense of the other nationalities of the Union? It's quite possible. To this vastly important question, it is impossible to answer as categorically as one would wish, because for in life it is decided not so much by collaboration, rivalry, and mutual fertilizations of culture as by the ultimate arbitrament of the bureaucracy. And since the Kremlin is the residence of the authorities, and the outlying territories are compelled to keep step with the centre, bureaucratism inevitably takes the colour of an autocratic Russification, leaving to the other nationalities the sole indubitable cultural right of celebrating the arbiter in their own language." So, however cautiously, he does point to the tendency of the Stalinist regime to act as an agency of privileging the dominant nationality over the smaller nationalities of the Union, despite the efforts of the early Soviet government under the Bolsheviks to create an equitable multinational union. And of course, this is one of the key issues that undermined the USSR, the whole national question and the centrifugal forces that resulted from Russification, from Russian domination. And it's a problem to this day. It's a legacy, a problem that legacy of which exists to this day. Now, just going on a bit further in the section, to the section immediately after he's really talking about the national question, he starts talking about culture and this idea of proletarian culture, which I think is of some interest, because Lenin, as he points out, Lenin and Trotsky rejected that concept, the concept that there was something inherently good about proletarian culture, working class culture. And the reason was this, is that the Marxist understanding is that the proletariat is an oppressed and exploited class whose historical mission is to create a classless society called communism, or by means of socialism, the lower stage. And the concept that proletarian culture has some inherently progressive content was at odds with that idea of the mission of the working class to abolish all classes, including itself, progressively dissolving them all into a classless society. And the Bolsheviks' view, in the main, was that the new classless society of the future would develop a higher culture, free from oppression and the elements of barbarism, that permeates all classes in a class society. So, for instance, Trotsky is rejecting the concept that the workers' state should dictate trends in art about which were proletarian and which were not. That was rejected by the Bolsheviks, and it's rejected by Trotsky. And he goes on, he spends a bit of time addressing this, and I'll quote him again. He says, "Although he had rather conservative personal tastes in art, Lenin remained personally, politically, extremely cautious in artistic questions, eagerly confessing his incompetence. The patronizing of all kinds of modernism by Lunacharsky, the People's Commissar of Art and Education, was often embarrassing to Lenin. but he confined himself to ironical remarks in private conversations and remained remote from the idea of converting his literary tastes into law. In 1924, on the threshold of the new period, the author of this book, i.e. Trotsky, thus formulated the relation of the state to the various artistic groups and tendencies, saying, while holding over them all the categorical criterion for the revolution or against the revolution, other than that, to give them complete freedom in the sphere of artistic self-determination. And he goes on, he says, while the dictatorship had a seething mass basis and a prospect of world revolution, it had no fear of experiments, of searchings, of the struggle of schools, for it understood that only in this way could a new cultural epoch be prepared. The popular masses were still quivering in every fibre and were thinking aloud for the first time in 1,000 years. All the best youthful forces of art were touched to the quick. During those first years, rich in hope and daring, there were created not only the most complete models of socialist legislation, but also the best productions of revolutionary literature. To the same times belong, it is worth remarking, the creation of those excellent Soviet films, which in spite of a poverty of technical means, caught the imagination of the whole world with the freshness and their vigour of their approach to reality. And that's completely at odds with what happened later, as the Stalinist regime began to prevail. So he elaborates on that. He says, in the process of struggle against the party opposition, the literary schools were strangled one after the other. It was not only a question of literature either. The process of extermination took place in all ideological spheres, and it took place more decisively since it was more than half unconscious. The present ruling stratum considers it called not only to control spiritual creation politically, but also to prescribe its roads of development. The method of command without appeal extends in like measure to the concentration camps, to scientific agriculture, and to music. The central organ of the party prints anonymous directive editorials having the character of military orders in architecture, literature, dramatic art, the ballet, to say nothing of philosophy, natural science, and history. And this stifling of creative thought had a thoroughgoing effect in closing off scientific innovation, for instance, by insisting that research should be narrowly oriented to immediate practical tasks. And, which, as he points out, is not of the best discoveries come across by deviating from immediate practical tasks. You know, and in the sphere of social science, including Marxism, things were even worse, as he elaborates a bit more. He says, in spite of the fact that Marxism is formally a state doctrine in the Soviet Union, there has not appeared during the last 12 years one Marxian investigation in economics, sociology, history, or philosophy, which deserves attention and translation into foreign languages. The Marxian works do not transcend the limit of scholastic compilations which say over the same ideas, endorsed in advance, and shuffle over the same quotations according to the demands of the current administrative conjuncture. Marxists who might say something valuable and independent are sitting in prison or forced into silence. And this in spite of the fact that the evolution of social forms is raising gigantic scientific problems at every step. And he goes on, even the explanatory notes to the complete works of Lenin are radically worked over in every new edition from the point of view of the personal interests of the ruling staff. The names of leaders magnified, those of opponents vilified, tracks covered up. And he says, facts are distorted, documents are concealed or fabricated, reputations are created and destroyed. A simple comparison of the successive variants of one and the same book during the last 12 years permits us to trace infallibly the process of degeneration of the thought and conscience of the ruling stratum. And he closes this section with, after going through that, with a scathing critique of the Stalinist regime, the effect of the Stalinist regime on art. And he says, no less ruinous is the effect of the totalitarian regime upon artistic literature. The struggle of tendencies and schools has been replaced by interpretation of the will of the leaders. There has been created for all groups a general compulsory organization, a kind of concentration camp of artistic literature. Gifted writers who cannot do sufficient violence themselves are pursued by a pack of instructors armed with shamelessness and dozens of quotations. The most eminent artists either commit suicide or find their material in the remote past or become silent. And it goes on. It says, the secretary of the Communist Youth said at a conference of writers, quote, the suggestions of Comrade Stalin are a law for everybody. And the whole audience applauded, although some doubtless burned with shame. As though to complete the mockery of literature, Stalin, who does not know how to compose a Russian phrase correctly, is declared a classic in the Master of Style. There's something deeply tragic in this Byzantinism and police rule, notwithstanding the involuntary comedy of certain of its manifestations. But unfortunately, the consequences were actually clear. And they admit it themselves, because, as he points out, he says, the leaders themselves are compelled to acknowledge that, quoting them, says, neither the first or the second five-year plan has yet given us a new literary wave that can rise above the first wave born in October. And that's very mildly said, actually. That's, in reality, in spite of individual exceptions, the epoch of Thermidor will go into the history of artistic creation preeminently as an epoch of mediocrities, laureates and toadies. And that's, I will conclude there, I think, because I think that goes into it in sufficient depth and people can discuss that. Hopefully they'll find that useful. Thank you, comrades. Who wants to speak on that?
Mark.
Marie?
I thought Mark wanted Mark? To speak.
Your volume
Which
is very low,
not?
Marie.
What was that?
Your volume is very low. Your voice is very quiet.
Oh, okay. Is that better now?
I think you just need to turn the microphone volume up a bit, possibly.
Okay.
If you can. I don't know if you can.
I shouldn't hear. Diana wants to speak.
Yeah, certainly, yes. Diana. You're muted, though.
Yeah, there are a few points, and there's something I saw in the text earlier that I want to find and I can't find again, but I'll have another look. it's going on about the different nationalities. I'm curious about the indigenous populations and their lifestyles. I saw recently an RT thing, one of their Inland Visions series, about northeastern population, which is actually culturally, ethnically very similar to the northwestern indigenous population in the northwestern bit of the Americas.
Uh-huh.
Go across the Bering Strait, and you've got a population which is very similar to their ethnicity and their culture to the ones in the northeast of Russia. I was wondering if there's any more information about those, any more information about what those populations, how those populations lived in the towards the end of the Tsarist regime and once the Soviets took over. I'd be interested in knowing more about those. It's not just those northeast ones, but there'll be indigenous populations like that across the Russian Federation, I would imagine, but certainly across other bits of Siberia, and then going towards the west, going towards the or what's been called Lapland. I don't know whether it still is.
Mm-hmm.
Some other things. I was intrigued by his comments about alphabets. He describes the Latin alphabet as democratic. How can an alphabet be democratic? and then he said something about the aristocratic Asiatic alphabets, which I assume would include Cyrillic, but Cyrillic aristocratic. It was invented. It's called Cyrillic because it was invented by a guy called Cyril around the 7th or 8th century, who was some sort of monk. Perhaps he was an aristocratic monk, I don't know. But I was a bit intrigued by that stuff. The thing that about when it comes to culture and science, what actually interests me is the Russian and Soviet ecology and biological sciences and their view there. Is what is actually consistent with Marx's view? They're non-mechanistic, non-reductionist. And we're plagued with the mechanistic, even still, the mechanistic and reductionist view of science and biological science and the way life and nature works. I don't know what that is part of the culture and science and stuff. And I don't know what Trotsky's view of that was. I've got books upstairs with lists of some of these Russian ecologists. And I suppose they'd have a cybernetic view as well. But the one who strikes me most is Nikolai Vavilov, who was supported by Lenin, and he did a lot of research, agricultural research, and collected traditional. Created a collection of traditional seeds used in agriculture and for food, and I think he's probably still remembered in Russia now. He got imprisoned by Stalin, but he died before Stalin could do the job. And there was a reference to. I can't remember whether. Oh, I think I saw it in one of John Bellamy Foster's books. I wondered whether I'd seen it in one of the World at War history thingies. But I think it was. But the two are linked up. But in the siege of Leningrad, there was people were starving and they were eating whatever they could get their hands on just to stay alive. But there was a vault somewhere in Leningrad, I think. I've forgotten the details of the seeds that Vavilov had collected. And the starving people would not touch those seeds. They were preserved. I think I've said enough for now.
Marie wants to speak, I think.
No, what's that?
Duke, can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you now, yeah.
All right. Is anybody else wanting to speak?
Well, I could come back on a couple.
After you, Marie.
Susan said.
No, after you, Marie, because you. It's okay, I can wait.
Susan said she will speak after, so I speak now.
Yeah. You speak now, Marie, then Susan, and I'll come back on a couple of things.
I think this is an outstanding piece of scientific study, as well as an intervention on the impact of revolution on the individual, on society, on art, and on democracy. And it seems to me it is a very complete piece. So I agree, of course, with everything Ian said. I will go back a little bit to what Diana say. I do not master exactly the matter, but I will speak about it later. I would like just to go back to the text a little bit, because some bits struck me as essential. Like, this is a truncated revolution, but it is nevertheless still, even under Stalin, has a continuation in a revolutionary way, which is not the purpose of Stalin, but which is the dynamic of the process itself. And so Trotsky says, the bureaucracy is laying down the bridge for them. He's talking about these nationalities and the parts of the Soviet Union which are less advanced, a bridge to the elementary benefits of bourgeois and even pre-bourgeois culture. This is how the proletarian workers and peasants, and not the bourgeois class, but in fact the proletariat, came to continue the historic role, the historic work that I'm paraphrasing, as this might not be correct, came to continue the historic work of Peter the First against the feudal grip of the old landed aristocracy and the clergy. And there's plenty to learn about this. And I think that when in that chapter here, he says this is not socialism, although the Stalin's bureaucracy speaks of socialism as part of this episode, as part of cultured socialist trade. That was when people were asking for baths and knitted clothes and essential of hygiene, for hygiene. The Stalin's bureaucracy spoke of this as part of cultured socialist trade. It is no such thing, of course. It's the commonplace methods of capitalist trade, and then there was hardly anything else about this. But nevertheless, it was progressive, and I think that when we analyze things, we mustn't always demand that it should be Marxist, but it should be progressive, and from there to draw the Marxist conclusions. This leap is progressive, he said, in the sense of custom and culture inherited from the best of tsarism, because it's not just the West that had invented hygiene, the best of tsarism and bourgeois Russia, which now begins to prevail in the 1930s. People look at the ready models of this in the West. So this is where the poverty of the intervention of the masses shows, that they are looking for the models in the West, copying the dress and manners of American engineers and technicians who happen to be moving around, or the Russian leaders who actually go to America, the fashions of the ladies of the West. It is some progress, but what this expresses, above all, is not the superiority of socialism over capitalism. It is
It expresses the prevailing of petit bourgeois culture over patriarchal life, the city over the village, the center over the backwoods, and the west over the east. I think this is valid. It was valid then, and it's still valid. When I visited Cuba, I could see this with my own eyes, the young trying to dress like Americans and with American styles and style of music and so on. This is when there is a lack of Marxist leadership, people get their inspiration as they can. And then there's just another aspect I would like to bring in. The Russian proletariat achieved the revolution in the name of much more far-reaching tasks that to learn from the West. Obviously, this is a basic recognition of the importance of the Russian Revolution. Now it's the proletariat in 1936 is politically suppressed, but it has not renounced the communist program, nor the mighty hope that came with it. I think I would like just to comment on this a little bit, that why did Stalin choose socialism in one country? He didn't say, I'm now giving up socialism. He still spoke for socialism. It would be in one country. That came from the fact that, on the whole, even with the immense retreat, there was no abandonment, and there was no reason to abandon, because there was development, however limited and truncated, there was still development, and people knew it and felt it. And so Stalin leadership, the bureaucracy, was never in a position to abandon. And I don't know whether, in fact, had the masses abandoned, they wouldn't have kept Stalin, they would have replaced him. And Stalin remained because he had an authority from his Bolshevik past. Mm-hmm. So I think this is quite an interesting aspect. And then about art, like you finished with this beautiful chapter, Ian, on the question of art. So this is where Trotsky says even the leadership around Stalin had to acknowledge that the second five-year plan, the first and the second five-year plan, failed to produce the literacy wave that was born from the October Revolution. This is super important, because they themselves, after all the idealization that they had made of the very, very limited advances, they had to accept that what had been produced by the revolution was superior to what was done afterwards. I would like to just cite the Soviet films. So there was Strike, Battleship Potemkin, that was 1924-25, Mother in 1926, October 1927, Earth 1930, and many more. Earth is by the Ukrainian director Oleksandr Dovzhenko, who also made Arsenal, which was a silent film in 1929, which remains, all these things remain tip-top of in the way of films. Earth deals with the process of collectivization and the hostility of the Kulak landowners under the first five-year plan. Earth, just the last bit, Earth was released on in April 1930 and was banned by the Soviet authorities 9 days later. That was the end of the wave of beautiful stuff. And then it was actually authorized when some scenes were removed from it. One of the scenes showed a Soviet workers pissing in the tank of a tractor, or something like that, which was far too close to reality and to the way things are in life. And, you know, when you idealize things, you don't want to go back down on this earth again. I congratulate them. All the comments who have
once this document to be studied, I think we need to study it again. And myself, I have understood only a part of it, and we should, I believe, we should continue to, with Trotsky, even if we have a pause from him.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Sure. Susan wants to speak. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Right. I followed up a while back, Diane, on the the sale of by the Tsar of Alaska to America, and looked at the contrast between that and the treatment of the treatment in America of the Alaskan indigenous people, which the Tsar had actually insisted that the Americans should respect their rights and their language. And that actually carried on until about 1926, at which point they were forcibly converted to, I presume it's Roman Catholic Christianity, and they were not allowed to carry on with their Eastern Orthodox, and nor were they allowed to carry on with their languages. So in many ways, but Trotsky doesn't mention that or what was happening at the time to people, which, given that he's writing in 1942 or in the 1930s, in a more Western thing, I think it's slightly unsettling. I think the other things, though, that I did want to mention, obviously, Trofim Lysenko had a unfortunate effect on, didn't you say his name was Vavilov, Diane? Yeah, you're muted, I think. Yeah, but
yes, Nikolai Vavilov.
The problem was Lysenko was another one of these charlatans who, you know, they talk a good talk, but he was selling nurture to Stalin, who was desperate to believe in it, because the whole point about the Soviet, or the, you know, the socialism of the Russian Revolution, was to believe that you could improve and make progress because of improving nurture, not because of nature. So it's more about fighting against it. I could never understand why they didn't take more notice of Kropotkin, who looked at commensalism and the whole business of species living together and working together, and using that as a Soviet model, which I felt was much more in tune with Soviet ideology. The other thing, though, that I found interesting was the fight over Russian folklore, and the fact that it became very popular in the 20s, the same as I was glad you mentioned the movies, because for me, Russian culture during the Soviet era, certainly the early era, is that massive flowering of the movies. And, you know, Battleship Potemkin stands up against any of the German school and the other, and the French school, for the early days of the movies. And it stood, you know, Russia stood quite well up to that. But I thought it was interesting that Stalin, certainly in the first five-year plan, tried to get rid of the folklore, which he felt was far too bourgeois. And I think it took Sokolov in the second or third to actually bring it back, recognize it as Russian culture, but more importantly, as working class culture, because Russian fairy tales were the stories of the people. Yeah, that's right, Diane. But these were the stories of the people. They were handed on as part of the oral tradition. And that's part of why, even when, as you say, other forms of Russian literature and art were suppressed, there was a big flowering of the schools of Russian literature in the forms of the folklore, although it's split into the two groups. I think one of them's the sort of more Slavic folklore, and the other one is the Finnish school, and the split between those. But Trotsky doesn't seem to have a lot of time for what I would call what are now seen as Russian culture, that is to say, the skills, the crafts, the ballet, and the you know, the movies. And why isn't that part of Russian culture? It seems like he was almost trying to impose something that he thought was not bourgeois, but it didn't feel like it came from the workers either. So that's my question, is I can see where a lot of it was coming in, but I can't see where Trotsky has identified what he felt was Russian culture. Rather that he bemoans, and he's quite right, the copying of Western culture as if it was going to be, because it was what was new. It was what was, you know, what people wanted. Yeah.
Can I come back on?
Very something? Difficult, but
yeah.
I was going to ask Mark whether he'd talk about Russian culture as he sees it.
Is anybody else to speak? Because I want to speak at some point, but if anyone wants to speak first, I'm quite happy to let them. Okay, seeing none, let me just say a couple of things. I mean, just on the question of so-called Asiatic languages, I don't think Trotsky is attacking the Cyrillic language, the Cyrillic alphabet as such. I think there were other forms of writing that existed in some of the in Central Asia that were possibly more akin to the languages of India, because there are numerous alphabets in India. There's about 7 or 8 of them, which are not really very mutually comprehensible, and they actually write down languages that have a lot in common, but they look different, you know. And I think that's probably what he was referring to about the Central Asia at that time. But I don't think Trotsky had a great deal of regard for the Cyrillic alphabet either, because at times it was overtly complicated and difficult to use. And the Bolsheviks actually reformed the Cyrillic alphabet, didn't they? They actually got rid of about 6 letters, and they changed the structure of it to simplify it. There were problems with it, and they made it more like Latin, the Latin alphabet. I mean, Trotsky says that Latin is democratic, probably because it's easy to, you know, it can be used to easily render lots of different languages. I think Cyrillic, to a certain extent, can do that as well, or at least the simplified versions of Cyrillic. But of course, if you look at other versions of Cyrillic, like Ukrainian and Serbian and whatever, you find some of those archaic letters are still there, you know, and they're different, you know. The Bolsheviks got rid of them. So I don't know. I mean, I think Trotsky was a person who spent a lot of time in the West, in London, in the United States even, and possibly had he was a Westerniser, you know. Lenin was also a Westerniser. And it's interesting that he quotes Peter the Great in the sense that he was a great Westerniser, Peter the First, you know. There are Russian nationalists who disagree with that and think he was, Peter the First was not a good thing, you know. Dugin thinks that, you know. Prefers the earlier versions of Russianism, as it were. But yeah, I mean, Cyrillic is right. You're right. It incorporates elements of Latin and Greek. You know, it's a composite, really. It is created by Saint Cyril from Old Church Slavonic or something like that, which is originally was a liturgical language, and it became the alphabet of many East European languages, though not all by any shot. It's quite complicated, actually. Just on the indigenous peoples in Siberia, I mean, I don't know how comprehensive Russian control of Siberia really was. Because, you know, Siberia, yes, obviously the Tsarist regime had conquered Siberia, and I think the instrument of doing that was the fur trade, you know, as I understand it. But it was always, you know, Siberia is not very well populated, is it? It's very underpopulated. It's very, very, you know, sort of spread out, the populations. And I'm not really sure how much, control they really had over it. I think they had nominal control over it. And obviously, if somebody tries to conquer it, they'd send an army to stop them, you know. But the main centres of population are in European Russia. And, you know, people complain about this to this day, you know, that Russia is overwhelmingly concentrated in the West, and that the eastern part of what is Russia, now the Russian Federation, is very, very sparsely populated. I really don't know much about those populations, to be honest. I don't know if anybody that I know knows much about them. They were not, obviously, they treated them differently to the way the peoples of the indigenous peoples of North America was treated. They were exterminated. I don't think that's true in Siberia. I think they were left alone. And as my understanding of it, anyway, and they were nominally under Russian rule for a very long time, for several hundred years. But I think they more or less were. They were not assimilated into a proper national state in the sense that we know in the West. You know, there is a big sort of difference in Russia anyway about its whole history with Asian migrations and Asian conquests, i.e. the conquests of the Mongols, etc. It's a very different history to the West, you know. And it probably bears it more investigation, actually. But a lot of those areas are sparsely populated to this day. And, things like the Trans-Siberian Railway and things like this were meant to actually partly remedy that, but they didn't really succeed, you could argue. But anyway, I'll leave it there. That Susan wants to speak. Susan.
Yeah, sorry about that. I'm trying to behave myself. Couple of things. One is, it's a level of how little, shall we say, supervision Russia had over Siberia that the 1908 meteor stroke comet explosion, the Tunguska, wasn't actually investigated, I think, until 1928 by any outsiders at all. And by that time, you know, you could still see the all the trees flattened in a circular area, you know, the dramatic pictures. But nobody had gone there to actually see what had happened or notice it, other than the local Siberian indigenous people. But the other thing is, I came across some really odd comments by Biden saying basically that Russia and China would be going back to war because it's the Chinese-Russian border. And I noticed that when Putin went to see Xi Jinping, he went to part of the border area where there are Russian people and Chinese people, you know, living perfectly happily on that part of the area. And that as far as they're concerned, they share a border. And America, I don't think, has any idea of actually the extent to which they are neighbors and are finding a way to get along. You know, whereas America's imperialism, and British and French for that matter, have always been about divide and conquer, about setting neighbors against each other. And they can't actually imagine the idea of people getting on. I suppose it's because in Europe, empires live cheek by jowl, you know, France and Germany at each other's throats, Britain and France having total contempt for each other, you know, not to mention Spain and Portugal and so on. You know, Europe is a country, an area smaller than Russia, but littered by wars between neighbours all the time, whereas Russia is a country that is so vast and yet so harsh in many ways. I mean, it's beautiful, but it's so harsh in terms of living. People have to live together if they're not going, you know, if they're going to survive. And yeah, they're going to live in the, you know, because of the Mongol hordes, but the population that lives in Moscow and St. Petersburg and the areas that have become urbanized, is that down to the Soviet era, or is that just down to the fact that people go where the living is easier? When climate warming heats up the tundra, will it become a land of milk and honey the way they might hope it? Yes. Well, it's got record levels of wheat production, hasn't it, this year and last? No?
Who knows? Who else wants to speak? Anybody else? Marie?
I think the railways are going to really open up Russia. And I think the big problem is going to be, how do people keep their ethnic identity in a world which is polluted and corrupted by Hollywood? And it's, you know, it's basically its CIA masters. No?
Sorry, I just had to shut the door because I can hear the noise.
You know, I don't. You know, if you compare the propaganda films of the that they complained about in Russia, there's nothing as bad as the current crop in of American movies. Oh, you know, they are so grotesque.
I think Marie wants to speak.
Go on, Marie.
You're muted, though.
Yeah, I think perhaps it's easy now, from where we stand, not to realise what it is that Trotsky did with his life, and how, I mean, he actually was assassinated for what he did, so it was... it wasn't just like he was investigating science and patronizing scientists or people to study this and that aspect of the amelioration of the relationship of science with agriculture or with geology. Or I mean, all these things he was supremely interested in, and he wrote about, actually wrote about all these things. But it seems to me one has to try to put oneself in what he did. From the beginning, he was involved in the experience of the first actually proper democratic functioning that was ever invented, which was the Soviet. And that was not a small thing. That took years, and it took preparation of years in Marxism, of life in the Bolsheviks, with the Bolsheviks, or alongside the Bolsheviks in polemics and in education of himself, educating himself, learning to appreciate what Lenin had done. Lenin had been the builder of the party. Trotsky had the selflessness to accept that he had not understood this very well, and he started doing it. That took years of preparation, theoretical and political preparation. This is, and then, you know, the defense of the conquest of civilization represented by Soviet functioning, which is still something we need now, which is more needed than ever. And so I call on the comrades to look at the context of Trotsky's intervention, at the dedication, at the selflessness, at the objectivity, because he did not make a trial of Stalin. He did not attack Stalin. He attacked the degeneration of the vulgarization and the trampling underfoot of the ideas of human fraternity, human equality and liberty and personal dignity. All this was trodden underfoot by all the people that were, and he wrote in exile. All this that he writes now that we have read today, he was being thrown out of Norway, and he was going to have to go to Mexico after having wondered where the hell he was going to go next. And he managed to think like this clearly, logically, and beautifully. These are examples to us of how to live a political life. Yeah.
Anybody else want to speak? Okay. Well, it looks like we've more or less come to the end of this discussion then, unless anybody else wants to speak. Because I don't want to, I think we've had quite a good discussion actually. It's not been enormously long, but sometimes they're not, you know. So if anybody wants to say anything more about this item, can they signal now? Otherwise, I think we should turn the recording off and go on to any other business, which might not be a bad idea actually, given the things that are going on. Is that okay with people? Yeah.
Yeah, I don't quite agree. I thought Susan mentioned something she had found unsettling. Can you hear, Susan? Have you disappeared?
No, I can hear.
Right. Could I ask you, what did you find unsettling? That would be a nice time to just investigate it and share in your concern.
No, no, it's is the real problem that what Trotsky achieved during the revolution and in the first sort of decade after it has just been so much wiped out of Russian history that you can't really evaluate it other than just reading his works.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. Yeah.
Okay.
Mm. I mean, there are bodies that study Trotsky's work in Russia now, that have been, you know, I'm not sure if it's very active, but such things were set up after the Gorbachev or during the Gorbachev period and probably continued for a while at least. But of course, they were subsumed by the terrible things that happened after the collapse of the Soviet Union. So I'm not really sure how much work they actually did after that, you know. But there are Trotskyist groups active to a degree in the former Soviet Union, but some of them are not that good, you know, which is true. Yeah. Well,
so it's the real problem, maybe, that until, you know, that I know a lot of people in the West, it feels like, who do appreciate the Russian Revolution, look in some horror over the fact that the Russian Federation appears to be coming to terms with its Stalinist past. And it seems to me that until it comes really to terms with that, it's not going to be able to resuscitate Trotsky, because the two are so much integral to the Russian Revolution post-Lenin. And I just wonder, is it something that you expect to happen that once people have got a better view of what Stalin was and wasn't, not through the filter of, you know, Western prejudice, that they will also, and it's the Russian view of Trotsky that I'm more interested in, because you get a lot of writing about it from a Western view, but it feels very unreal. It's sort of, it's not quite Disneyfied, but it's through other people's filters. It's not, it doesn't feel like it's what the Russians would say about it.
Yeah, I do understand. I mean, I must admit, I have actually not read a great deal about Trotsky that's of Russian origin, a recent Russian origin, except for I don't think that some of the contemporary currents treat Trotsky as an enemy of what was the Soviet Union. And the one person that I have read a fair number of his writings is Dugin. Now, he's a right winger. But he actually treats Trotsky as any other Bolshevik. He treats him as a Bolshevik. Yeah. You know, there's no distinction. He does actually talk about him, but he doesn't really see him as any different to the other revolutionary Bolsheviks, which he has a a critical support position for, which is very strange, actually. It's an aspect of the peculiarity of Russia today, that sort of...
the other thing, though, I was going to ask about, was Russian science fiction. I mean, I was a huge reader of Isaac Asimov, who was, Russian. And, he's very different, shall we say, to many other science fiction writers of the time. But I was introduced to some of the more modern Russian science fiction. It has the it has a flavour and quality of its own that does, you can tell it's very different to, Western science fiction or science fiction of the sort of American or British science fiction of the 30s or the 50s or the 70s, and the new science fiction and where the roots of that come from. Because it seems to me that I'm not a huge fan of, shall we say, grand literature, but I am very interested in both crime and science fiction literature because they reflect the interests and concerns of the people in a very more, shall we say, more ordinary people and the things that they see in society. And many of the authors of science fiction and crime fiction reflect what's going on in society in a way that, what I'd call the academic literature, yes, the bourgeois literature, if you want to call it, the chick flicks and the rest of it, are very interested in, what you can sell, the consumerism and the society, but they're not interested in the spiritual and the cultural and the deeper part of what makes this group of people, is it the landscape that shapes the people or is it the way in which the community works together? Anyway, sorry, Paul, I've rabbited on. Do carry on.
I think it might be quite difficult to find out what Ruskin's probably taught Kropsky because much of what Ruskin think of Kropsky today will obviously be influenced by the bourgeoisie since the fall of the Soviet Union. So I think even in Russia it will probably be quite difficult to actually establish what people really thought of Kropsky in Russia at that particular time. The other point I wanted to make is that whilst we have a tendency to use modern day examples, which can be helpful when reading old texts, I do rather tend to appreciate Marie's skill of actually going back to the text and saying, hold on a minute, we have to remember that this was written in 1936 or whenever it was. I think it was 1937. And I think it is that we do have to remember. It's all very well having views about what we think now, but we do have to remember it in the context of time. I just wanted to make that general comment, that was all. Thanks.
Anybody else wants to speak?
I've got a quick question yeah, for sure. Susan, actually. Based upon what you've just said, Susan, have you read Sam Yartin's We, which I'm about to start?
No. Is it good, and is it on a PDF?
I can get on a PDF. I don't know, because I'm about to start it. I haven't started it yet.
Have you?
I don't know if anyone else has read it. Sorry, Susan?
No, I'll look it up and see. I presume it's We, W-E, and not...
It is. It is. It was a big influence on Orwell's 1984, apparently, so...
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm looking Trotsky in 1937 is writing, you know, in a world where all, not so much Orwell, but what's his name? The guy who wrote The Day of the Triffids, you know?
John Wyndham.
Yeah. Yes. You know, dystopian science fiction was all the rage in the 1930s. They just couldn't imagine a future that wasn't going to be, you know, vile, ghastly and grey. And you know, that was their whole thing. And you're looking at it and going, no, actually, the future is full of Hugo Boss and Nazi, you know, jackboots running around everywhere. They just didn't, you know, people got their priorities wrong.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Maybe not. Maybe they just refracted them through different spheres and came up with slightly modified answers. Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. My world's disappearing into one vast conspiracy theory from the British Empire, as far as I can see, which is still trying to trample over everything. Did you see Macron disappearing off to... Oh, New Caledonia, it turns out, is part of France, and therefore, you know, these poor people have got to accept French laws and their laws are all passed in Paris. And I'm
that's
just
not new,
though.
They used to say the same thing about Algeria, that Algeria was part of France. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, you're just looking at it and going, why doesn't anyone see that as, you know, that's culture wars taken to the absolute extreme? No?
It makes it stupid.
In the West, we regard it as some sort of, aren't we generous? We've given these poor benighted people a Western culture as if somehow it's a benefit, when in reality it's just us, you know, enslaving them and depriving them of everything that made them themselves. And then we have the gall to go and lecture people on identity politics. I just despair sometimes.
Ooh, don't despair.
No. Then I see you and cheer up again.
How about the ideas of Trotsky?
Oh, dear.
Anyway, can we conclude this discussion?
Yep,
and we come
please
to the
do.
Next point on the agenda? I'm going to stop the recording. Yeah.
Oh, dear. I didn't realise we were still recording.
Got